Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. I am Danny Beal, today's worship associate. I am joined in welcoming you this morning by Damaris Davis, today's worship leader. Damaris is an artist and activist who taught English at Northwestern and Cleveland State University. Her talks, shows, and sermons are rooted in the historic background of today's issues. We are delighted to have her here today for this lay-led service. Heidi Emhoff was also involved in the creation of today's service as the coordinator. Together every Sunday, and often in the days between, we share our loves, our losses, our sorrows, and our moments of glory, grace, and mercy. You were with my family through our years of struggling to expand our family, and now you are with us sharing in the joy of our baby Pax. We each play our own role in this community as religious education leaders, activists for social justice, and worship associates, as committee members, board members, and makers of pancakes. Our world is messy, glorious, and ultimately unfair. It is with you that I learned to make sense of this, and it is with you that I have chosen to share these years of my life. Come, let us worship together. Damaris will be sharing with us a piece of Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha for our time for all ages, as our Director of Religious Education, Karen Lapidus, is away this week.
Longfellow wrote this poem in 1885, when very little was remembered about the Indians except for a kind of lurking uneasiness that maybe we had done them wrong. It was a terrifically popular poem. And I just want to read to you a few lines that give you a feeling of the flavor of this. By the shores of Gitche-Gumee, that's Lake Superior, by the shining big sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis. Nokomis was Hiawatha's grandmother, and the two of them were a family. And it tells many things Nokomis taught him of the stars that shine in heaven, showed him Ishkuda, the comet, Ishkuda with fiery tresses, showed the death dance of the warriors, that's the northern lights, showed the death dance of the spirits, warriors with their plumes and war clubs, flaring far away to northward in the frosty nights of winter. Showed the broad white road in heaven, that's the Milky Way. Pathway of the ghosts, the shadows, running straight across the heavens, crowded with the ghosts, the shadows. At the door on summer evenings sat the little Hiawatha, heard the whispering of the pine trees, heard the lapping of the waters, sounds of music, words of wonder. When he heard the owls at midnight hooting, laughing in the forest, "What is that?" he cried in terror. "What is that?" he cried, Nokomis. And the good Nokomis answered, "That is but the owl and owlet talking in their native language, talking, scolding at each other." Of all the beasts, he learned the language, learned their names and all their secrets, how the beavers built their lodges, where the squirrels hid their acorns, how the reindeer ran so swiftly, why the rabbit was so timid, talked with them whene'er he met them, called them Hiawatha's brothers. Souls, let us gather. Let our hearts awaken to compassion. Let us awaken from this illusion of separateness. Still your thoughts. Only awaken.
Grandfather, look at our brokenness.
We know that in all creation, only the human family has strayed from the sacred way.
We know that we are the ones who are divided.
And we are the ones who must come back together to walk in the sacred way.
Grandfather, Sacred One, teach us love, compassion, and honor.
That we may heal the earth and heal each other. This morning in this place, I have such a good feeling. I'm so happy to be here with you. And in the interests of full disclosure, let me say that I am going to talk about Hiawatha, but there will be a few detours. The detours are about me and some people I know, and their true stories. And so, I think, is the one about Hiawatha. But the Hiawatha story is very old, and it has, over time, become something more. A great story. My stories are about individual people. But Hiawatha's story is mythic. In other words, it's historically rooted. But along the way, it has become something more. It encompasses all the little stories that I'm going to tell you. And it holds wisdom enough still to guide many people. So first, here's my story. I was an only child of two only children, which left me without many relatives. We were a close-knit, loving little family. My mother was British and kind of reserved, but my dad was always available emotionally and a lot of fun, and we were very close. Then one night, just after I'd turned 18, he suddenly felt ill. And an hour later, he died in front of me and my mother at the hospital. We rode down the elevator, numb with shock. We drove back home without him, forevermore without him, just as the sun was coming up. My mom, when we got home, quietly went and lay down on the bed with a headache. And I felt empty, wandered into my room, and started doing my botany homework. Neither of us even thought about having a funeral. We had good friends and caring neighbors, but we weren't churched. And we didn't want a lot of fuss with funeral salesmen or preachers or rituals. I look back and I remember that my mom and I talked often and lovingly about my father. But from this long distance, I begin to realize I don't think we talked about our feelings about what had happened to him. She had a sort of taboo from the way she was raised, what I interpret as a sort of British feeling that we don't expose our emotions, and the deeper they are, the more we cover them up. And our dear friends and our neighbors kept in very close touch with us and were very supportive, but clearly, even then, I could see that they were also kind of shy about intruding on these enormous feelings that we had, which is, I'm sure you know from your own experience, the way people often are at such times. Well, the numbness eventually began to wear off. I felt as if I'd been split by lightning. I felt as if I'd been knocked out of orbit and hurled into endless freezing space. I had never imagined anything could hurt so much. I remember consoling myself that it was a very good thing that I was 18 years old now and all grown up, or losing my dad would really have been devastating. Obviously, I had no idea what was happening to me. And a lot of strange, unreal things were happening to me. I recall how much, how continuously, how simply I wanted to die. Month after month, I couldn't fall asleep until the sun rose. It felt strangely as though I was on another planet, and every conversation seemed to be reverberating endlessly through time. But I dealt with this torture the only way that I knew. I hid it. I behaved normally, correctly. I finished college. I went to graduate school, made straight A's. But it was hell on the inside. Finally, one day, I went to the infirmary after 4 consecutive days and nights without any sleep at all, and was diagnosed with full-blown major depression. I tell you all this through the eyes of hindsight. At the time I accepted this awesome thing that had happened to me as if it were some kind of merited personal judgment against me. But I know now how utterly ordinary my experience was. And I say this because in my isolation, in my emotional ignorance, in my desire to do and be the right thing, I did make an assumption which I believe our culture encourages us to make, that grief belongs to the individual, that responsible modern individuals must manage their losses privately and get back to normal as quickly as possible. In fact, we put this pressure even more on children and teenagers who are bereaved. Get them back to school. Get them back to normal. I tell you this because I suspect something similar may at one time or another have happened to you. And I will tell you about Hiawatha because it happened to him. And he did something marvelous about it. Once upon a time, probably about 600 years ago, there was a large and powerful Native American group living around the Great Lakes, whom their long-suffering neighbors referred to as the rattlesnakes, the Iroquois. They were said to have been originally one large family that had moved south from Canada and divided into groups whose names are all around us, the Mohawks, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Seneca, the Cayuga, and later, in 1712, the Tuscarora. The accounts that have come down to us, which are now gradually becoming available, are that they were stealthy warriors who liked to kill. Because at some point in their history, the Iroquois had begun to make a terror campaign against their neighbors, raiding, murdering, taking prisoners for torture, even descending to cannibalism. In fact, they even frequently betrayed one another and then revenged themselves. And at the epicenter of this madness was the Onondaga war chief, Otto Darho, called the Entangler. Pictures depict him as a terrifying sorcerer with a headdress of convulsing snakes. Otto Darho led the Iroquois to victory again and again over their enemies, but to his own people, he was a treacherous tyrant, clever and crafty, a secret killer whose assassins murdered anyone who stood up to him. Now, at the same time that I happened to be researching Hiawatha for no very good reason, except I was looking for sermon topics and this appealed to me. This was around 2004, I think it was. I was also studying bereavement and how to minister to bereaved families, plus things like funeral and memorial rituals. And one thing really grabbed me about the destructive behavior of the Iroquois, and that was, to somebody who was learning what I was learning, that their funeral practices were truly perverse and dysfunctional. For instance, after a death, the first thing a family did was run amok for a week or more. We haven't tried that, I don't think. Attacking other tribes, destroying things, and demanding presents from others. The dead body itself was subjected to endless weird rituals and retained in the living quarters with the family until the stench of the decay was totally unbearable. Only then was it buried, but not for long. After a while, it was dug up again and submitted to more rituals. If a chief died, all bets were off and his place was up for grabs. And besides the usual berserk psychological behavior, there was vicious competition to succeed him and more murders, revenge killings, and schizoid funerals. I'm trying to say, if you're entering into working with the bereaved, this is not the kind of behavior you want to see in your community. In fact, I made a kind of a simple-minded flow chart for what I think the emotional source of this turmoil after death might be. For instance, say that someone undergoes a trauma, some kind of major loss or abuse, something that throws them off balance emotionally. Say then that they get stuck in that wilderness, what the tribes call the gray cloud time, with no help from outside to help orient them toward what we call the grief work that is so necessary after a major disappointment or loss. Instead of healing, these folks had no community response or emotional support, and their psychic anguish just festered. Now, bad outcomes like this can go one of two ways according to the personality and the circumstances. You can implode into depression and despair, or you can explode into rage, abuse, destructiveness, vindictiveness, and extend the damage and demoralization to others who will pass it on. And that's what I think I see in Otto Darho and his victims. Now, Hiawatha was also a high chief of the Onondaga, a family man, living quietly, past middle age, widely loved for his wisdom and his benevolence and his ability to talk and persuade. And guess what? Otto Darho hated Hiawatha, but he must also have feared him, because for all his hatred, Otto Darho never confronted Hiawatha personally. Instead, the story goes, Otto Darho had Hiawatha's family killed so as to destroy him from afar. He had Hiawatha's daughters killed and then hid their bodies so that they could not be buried and their ghosts would be forced to wander forever. Hiawatha confronted Atodarho in front of everyone, but his people were so afraid that no one would speak for him against Atodarho. At that point, Hiawatha's own heart broke, and he fled to wander alone in the wilderness. Okay, that's the worst of it. We're past that. I said, the Iroquois knew this kind of period of wandering after a major upset in your life as the gray cloud time. And people who study bereavement know that how much of this time is spent and how successfully it is passed through depends on the conditions. For instance, say you lose a mate at a good old age after many years together, a good relationship, perhaps a brief illness. The death is expected, the circumstances are normal, and it has been anticipated, and if other elements are stable, you can assume that the remaining spouse will recover, and the amount of time given is approximately a year. A year. And during that time, it has to be assumed that even though the person is behaving pretty well and coming along normally, that... Sorry, I missed my place. And even if the conditions are normal, you can assume that someone in this condition will take about a year. But if there are exacerbating conditions, then the prognosis becomes much more difficult. For instance, I had to write this out by longhand. I'm sorry, my printer wouldn't work. The point is that even in those circumstances, it's a very bad idea to let someone who is recovering make decisions. For instance, normally you will see people who decide to throw their spouse's clothes out and all their belongings, get rid of it, start over. People may decide to sell the house or do something else, like, you know, a complete life change. And the idea is for someone supporting and caring for this person that you try to steer them away from making those kind of decisions, because during this time, when this person's identity is going from one situation where you are in a relationship and so on, to where that is removed and you have to find a new balance, a new identity as your own self, for instance, that even though you may be feeling relatively okay, your thinking is still somewhat irrational. And if you add in these more disturbing circumstances, for instance, if the death is unexpected, or if the death is by violence, or if the life is cut short at an early age, then there's much greater risk of trouble in this process. And I say this all and put you through this because I think it is so important that we be aware of this. Everyone needs to be aware of this. You know, there can be decisions made in that isolation that a person feels after a death, which can inflict damage on the rest of the life. For instance, an old lady I knew told me at a wedding reception that early on in her life, she had a baby, and the little thing died at a very early age. And she said to me, and when I saw that beautiful child lying in the coffin, she said, I decided that there could not be any God, or this wouldn't have happened. And she said proudly, "I never told anyone." What I mean is, you can take a decision like that, maybe consciously or unconsciously, and never expose it, never talk it over, never put it through the support of somebody else. We also know probably of couples who've lost a child, and the relationship very often cannot sustain after that kind of shock. So anyway, here's Hiawatha in his own bereavement, and he took to the wilderness, as so many great healers have done, and he wandered far and for a long time with terrible grief and anger, until finally one day, as the sun rose, a woman who was going for water outside her village saw a man lying on the ground, and she fled back to get help. And living in her village was another great man of Indian myth, Dakanawida. He was not a chief. The records say that he had some kind of speech impediment, made it hard for him to be a leader, but he was known far and wide as a wonderful counselor. And under his care, Hiawatha gradually came back to his own mind. And on that, he went back to his people. And to those people, he brought gifts that changed the way they conducted themselves, restored peace, and descended to us today. The first one was called the condolence ritual. That was meant to take away those dysfunctional practices around the funerals and replace them with something that was really necessary. Now, most people who are trained in religion are aware that ritual is a very, very interesting and powerful thing. There's sound reasons for using it. For instance, any time you make a transition from one stage of your identity to another, when one thing is broken down, for instance, like by retirement, and you go on to another part of your life, that's a transitional time. And over the years, human beings have learned that those can be difficult times, and they need to be worked through very carefully. So, the point of the ritual is to take the person into the community, the group of community around you. And this is why I think that I suffered for so long, because we had none of this. We didn't think it was necessary. And now I think maybe it was. Anytime, whether it's a bereavement or a new marriage or the birth of a child, these are all transitions. They are changes in identity. And with the community around us and with these formal rituals, people tend to benefit from them. Why? Because first of all, there is acknowledgement. Have you ever been bereaved or carried a grief and nobody seemed to know about it, or if they did know, they didn't address it? And most of us do that because we don't want to intrude. We don't know what to say. We might say the wrong thing, you know. On the other hand, if you've ever been on the other side of that, you know just how lonely a thing that can be. Ritual also gives us a structure. Ritual has a strange way of allowing us to walk through a situation with a supportive community around us. Even though we may be in a condition, as at weddings or funerals, when you barely know what's happening to you, the idea is that it has a kind of unconscious effect which carries over. Just walking through, just acknowledging the emotion, just finding the connection to the permanent values of the community. Because good or bad, happy or sad, at these times of major transitions in life, we have chaotic feelings. We have fears as well as triumphs, and they need to be acknowledged. They need to be reconciled. Joseph Campbell said that religion and myth and ritual all have the object of helping us human beings to bear and interpret our suffering and to be comforted. And I think in a way that is true. It keeps a community like Hiawatha's from going rogue, acting out their pain and their confusion on others. You see this, for instance, with people who've been abused in early life, and they very often become bullies, people who like to pass that abuse on, like the men who like to kill. And the last gift that Hiawatha brought, besides rearranging the way that his people dealt with their grief, the other gift he brought back was the great peace. It was a system of governance. It was a way of cutting down, letting six tribes live together in peace. It was called the Great Binding Law. One of the first things about it was that group rights and individual rights were very carefully balanced. The various tribes made their own rules for their own people, but when they got to the Senate, and they have a Senate, when they got to the Senate, none of them was allowed to express a personal opinion. The opinion was made up by the particular group and was voiced by somebody, but it was a group opinion. You had the group and the individual balanced as to rights. You had a system where every group spoke, and there was an expectation that there would be compromise. The power came up from below, not down from above. What's more, under the Great Peace, no longer did the Iroquois attack their neighbors, but they made their territory a sanctuary. And if someone who was even an Iroquois enemy was escaping from an enemy of his own and he got into Iroquois territory, the Iroquois would protect him. This is a radical change. The idea was sort of like Soul Force, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi. The idea was that peace expands. That when we have compassion, and when we reach out, and when we protect others, and so on, that it has an influence which gradually accumulates. And in fact, people did. Other tribes join in and extend the peace. And the idea that Hiawatha had was that the peace would eventually reach the whole world. Well, it didn't. It lasted 200 years until the Europeans came. But there is something else, and we are the beneficiaries of this peace. The Indians had a constitution. And it began, "We the people, in order to form our union, to have good government, give the people welfare, preserve nature, and continue the peace." Thomas Jefferson, John Rutledge, Benjamin Franklin spent a lot of time talking to Iroquois leaders and taking advice from them. And the result that we have today is manifest in our own Constitution. So I think there is still hope for the great law of peace. Thank you very much. I know I put you through a good deal, but you know, I'm going to tell you one more story, may I? Okay. One more story. This was, lo and behold, when my daughter reached 18, her father died. And she too became depressed, really terribly depressed. It was a horrible time. She was collecting honors and A's and all that, and she was invited to all kinds of dinners, and she said to me, I wish I could enjoy some of this. It was a rough time because I would give everything I had to try to pick her up and give her some courage so that she could go on with the next day, and then when she left, I would just collapse. It was terrible. But one day she said to me, she said, if I only had some idea why I'm feeling like this, why I'm suffering like this. And something just came to me, and I said what I've believed ever since. I said, honey, once you've been through this, you will get out of it. But once you've been through it, you will be able to see other people who are in danger of this very same thing. And you will be able to reach out to them. And you will be able to help them. And I'm very happy to say that that has happened repeatedly in her family. And that is, again, what I think about the great peace. I think that we are the instruments of that peace. I think that if we overcome our doubts and our fears and reach out to others, either for help or to give help, that we're making the world a better place. Thank you very much. If we agree in love, there is no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace.